the reliability of the New Testament manuscripts. We already looked at manuscript evidence and showed the New Testament to be the most reliable of all ancient writings when you just examine the manuscripts. Then we went to the apostolic fathers, the pupils of the apostles whom the apostles selected to lead the early church, and showed that they quoted from the New Testament and confirmed the message of the New Testament. They taught Christ's deity, sacrificial death, resurrection, and salvation only through Christ. And now we're talking about ancient secular writings and how they confirmed the message of the early church. We talked about Thallus, Tacitus, Suetonius, Pliny the Younger, Emperor Trajan, Emperor Hadrian. And now we'll take a look at a little excerpt from the Jewish Talmud. And again, I'm referring to Habermas's Ancient Evidence for the Life of Jesus. This book is back in print now, and it's enlarged and updated in the Historical Jesus, published by College Press, by Gary R. Habermas. Let me see if I can find his quote here from the Talmud. Okay. Habermas writes about the Talmud that the Jews handed down a large amount of oral tradition from generation to generation. This material was organized according to subject matter by Rabbi Akiba before his death in 135 AD. His work was then revised by his student Rabbi Meyer. The project was completed about 200 AD by Rabbi Judah and is known as the Mishnah. Okay. It says ancient commentary on the Mishnah was called the Gemaras. The combination of the Mishnah and the Gemaras formed the Talmud. It says that it would be expected that the most reliable information about Jesus from the Talmud come from the earliest period of compilation, 70 to 200 AD, known as the Tanaitic period. In the passage Sanhedrin 43a comes from that period. So this is oral tradition that was put down in written form between 70 and 200 AD, but some of that tradition predates it and may actually go back to the rabbis from the time of Christ. Now, they refer to Jesus as Yeshu. It says, on the eve of the Passover, Yeshu was hanged. And the hanged was the way the Jews spoke of crucifixion because it alluded to the Old Testament passage that cursed is anyone who's hanged on a tree. On the eve of the Passover, Yeshu was hanged. For 40 days before the execution took place, a herald went forth and cried, "He's going forth to be stoned because he practiced sorcery and enticed Israel to apostasy. Anyone who could say anything in his favor, let him come forward and plead on his behalf." But since nothing was brought forward in his favor, he was hanged on the eve of the Passover. Okay, so here you have him being crucified on the eve of Passover. So everything is consistent here with what we find in the New Testament. But the really important thing for our purposes of defending the Christian faith is that it is stated here by his enemies that he practiced sorcery. Just as as Luke refers to Simon as Simon the sorcerer and acknowledges that this guy had supernatural power, so too the enemies of Christ acknowledge that Jesus had supernatural power. But it's just like Thallus trying to explain away the supernatural aspects of Christ's life by trying to explain away the darkness that occurred at the crucifixion. Here you have the Jews trying to explain away the supernatural aspects of Christ's life. And so basically, that confirms the New Testament accounts that the Pharisees could not disprove the miracles that Jesus was performing. Therefore, they said, okay, yeah, but he does these things by the power of Satan. And but they were acknowledging a supernatural power at work in Jesus. And just the fact that they have the crucifixion in the locked on in the on the eve of Passover, it shows that even his enemies admitted it was a real historical fact, and they're identifying the approximate time period as well. You also have in the Jewish Talmud, Habermas doesn't have the quote here, but there's actually tradition of the rabbis that Jesus was illegitimate and that his real father was not Jewish, was a Gentile, and some later speculation even claimed he was a Roman soldier. Why would you go into all this speculation about who Jesus' real father was unless it was known that Joseph, Mary's husband, was not Jesus' real father? So it's a roundabout way to just to confirm that the virgin birth accounts were very ancient. In fact, Charlesworth from Princeton says that the Luke and Matthew would have never invented the virgin birth accounts, because if you're going to start a new religion, you don't invent beliefs, you don't invent doctrines. You only invent doctrines, if you're going to make up your own religion, you would only invent doctrines that are essential for your religion. You're not going to invent peripheral doctrines that could explode in your face and give your enemy ammunition. Okay? So they could have just said that, you know, Jesus was God, but he wasn't born of a virgin. But by saying that he was born of a virgin, it was going to allow the enemies to say, well, maybe he was illegitimate. And, you know, no one's going to want to do that and make their enemy opponent's job any easier. Lucian was a 2nd century writer, probably wrote about 170, 180 A.D. And he stated this: the Christians, you know, worship a man to this day, the distinguished personage who introduced their novel rites and was crucified on that account. He talks about the beliefs of Christians, that they believe they are immortal for all time, which explains the contempt of death and voluntary self-devotion which are so common among them. So he was acknowledging that they were dying for their faith. And then he says that they worship the crucified sage and live after his laws. So he says that that Christ was crucified, Christians were willing to die for him because they believed that their eternal destiny was settled by him. And again, he says that they worship a man to this day. So he's acting like, you know, hey, we're modern people. We live in 170, 180 A.D., we're modern people. We don't hold to the ancient phony baloney myths. But those Christians, man, they're still worshiping a guy to this day. So, but he's basically saying, he's implying that they've been doing it for several generations. So he's saying that they still worship Jesus, as if it's common knowledge to his readers that Christians are those who worship Jesus. So he's pushing that date back. So that confirms it as well. I mean, you know, if you want to deny all of these ancient secular writers are confirming the New Testament account, then you have to do it in the way that Michael Martin did. And by the way, Michael Martin, the guy that I debated on God's existence, He not only wrote Atheism, A Philosophical Justification, where he argues for atheism, but he also wrote The Case Against Christianity, where he argues against Jesus' existence, against the resurrection, against Christ's deity, and he refers to Habermas as the number one evangelical apologist when it comes to the historical evidence for the resurrection. But the way he does it is he basically just says, look, the Christian post-biblical accounts of Christ are not historically reliable because they got their information from the New Testament, which Martin assumes is not historically reliable. And the ancient secular writers, their views of what the Christians believed was not really reliable because they got that information from biased Christians. So I mean, it's like the problem with that view is every possible piece of historical evidence that you could hope to find in manuscripts, you know, the writings of the eyewitnesses themselves, the pupils of the eyewitnesses, their pupils, ancient secular authors who would confirm what they believe, every possible ancient writing, Christian or non-Christian, he's got a way of rejecting it. So it's like, is there any evidence you will accept for Jesus? And then there really isn't. So it's kind of like, he presupposes Jesus didn't exist. So, the apostles were biased when they recorded it. And these guys got the information from the apostles. The ancient secular writers got it from people who heard it from the apostles. But it just does not follow. I mean, it's just a weak argument. And in fact, for ancient events, just one account of one event is usually enough for historians to record it as a real bona fide historical event. It's only with the New Testament where they have to, they claim, well, we need witnesses outside of the New Testament. So you can have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all attesting to Christ's resurrection. Paul, a fifth guy referring to it. And then you can have Peter referring to it in his writings. So now you got at least six different references to it, different guys. But that's not enough because they're all kind of part of one book, supposedly the Bible, rather than six different references. So they still want more confirmation than that. And the fact of the matter is they get it. But usually just one reference, one recording of an event is enough from ancient literature because we just don't have that much evidence from ancient literature. Now the only other guy I wanted to look at is Josephus. This is very controversial. But I do believe that, by the way, Habermas goes into the Gospel of Thomas and other Gnostic heretical works, because even though they were heretical works, so these guys are not in cahoots with the Christians, but they acknowledge some type of historical resurrection. Now they fabricate the account and add details, but they acknowledge the historicity of the resurrection, and this is written about 140 A.D. So you have Gnostic sources like the Gospel of Truth, the apocryphal work of John, and the Gospel of Thomas. But I want to spend a little bit of time talking about Josephus. Okay, Josephus was a Jew that basically was hired by the Romans. After the Romans lambasted Jerusalem, it was kind of Josephus' way to be in good favor with the Romans, was to record a history of the Jews for the Romans. Some consider him a traitor for siding with the guys who conquered his people. But the fact of the matter is, he does give a fairly biased historical account in favor of the Jews, which you could argue, okay, maybe he was out to save his own neck, but in the process, he managed to show the Jews in real good light to the Romans. So there's some mixed feelings about where he stands. Was he out to save his neck? You bet. But he really didn't view himself as betraying his people, though some would say that. Let me read you the account that's in the works of Josephus. By the way, you can get this hardcover. It might be a soft cover now, but they sell for $9.99 CBD, Christian Book Distributors. So it's a dynamite work. And they record not only the account about Jesus, but it also records the account of James, the half-brother of Jesus, his death. And that's real important because James is referred to, it says, talking about James, and it says, the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James. Okay? So he's saying that Jesus, who's called Christ or Messiah, his brother's name is James. If Josephus never mentioned Jesus, the Christ, it really doesn't make much sense why he would describe. He's like, okay, I'm going to tell you about this guy named James. Now, James is the brother of the Jesus who was called Christ. Well, if Josephus never told the Romans about Jesus who was called Christ, then he's not identifying James. But since he's using Jesus who was called Christ to identify James, it implies that he mentioned Jesus who was called Christ somewhere earlier. Lo and behold, there's only one passage about Jesus here. Now let me say this, the passage I'm going to read is translated by William Whiston, who is by far, or at least was by far, the leading Josephan expert. Okay? Based on the style, based on the manuscript evidence, he included this paragraph in this book. So what I'm basically saying is this longer paragraph, as weird as it sounds, to become, and by the way, Josephus lived from 37 AD to 97 AD. So, you know, Jesus died around 30 AD. You know, this guy was 33 years old when the temple was destroyed. And when he died in 97 AD, he probably died right around the time the Apostle John died. So this, when he talked to eyewitnesses, I mean, he could have talked to the apostles themselves or people who knew the apostles themselves, okay? I seem to be from the Pharisee camp, so you're talking a big connection with Jerusalem. Whatever the case, this guy was very close to the events. But Whiston includes this, what I'm about to read here. So let me read this. It's on page 480 in the... it's got some interesting information about Pilate, by the way, as well. But it's on 480 in the works of Josephus, completed and unabridged.
Like a chapter of book 80 number.
Yeah, they do, but he's got it on this side. It's book 18, chapter 3, point 3. So book 18, chapter 3, point 3. And he says this. Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians, so named from him, are not extinct at this day. Okay? So that's the quote that Whiston includes. The reasons for rejecting this are not manuscript reasons. Not translation reasons either. The reasons for rejecting is they're saying, look, this guy was a Jew. He was not a Jewish Christian. He was a Jew. Why would he call Jesus Christ, Messiah, if he didn't believe he was the Messiah? Why would he say he rose from the dead if he didn't believe in Jesus? Why would he say he did wonderful works, you know, miracles and in a good light, if he wasn't a believer? So, yeah, Mark, you had something?
Oh, I thought it was because one of the first translators, I think it was a monk, that translated his work for Christians in general, and they were biased, and they just filled it in.
Well, that's what the claim is. The claim is that some Christian took this. Now, the radical claim of non-Christian scholars, historical scholars, is that some Christian just inserted this, and Josephus never even mentions Jesus. Problem is, he identifies James as the brother of Jesus who was called Christ. So it's pretty well accepted that, okay, Josephus said something about Jesus. The problem is, would he come right out and say that? Let me say this. There are a lot of things you will find in Josephus's writings that if he really believed everything he was reporting, he would believe things that an intelligent man probably wouldn't believe. He would believe things that seem to contradict. I kind of lean in the direction that this could be authentic, in that he was the kind of guy who would just talk to either eyewitnesses, or if eyewitnesses weren't around, you know, if he's talking about pre-flood times, then he just goes to the scripture. But he goes to what he considers the most reliable sources or experts he could find, and then he just writes it as they tell it. And he just lets the reader decide.
Well, what I was going to mention, Jesus, according to some scholars, was a common name at the time. Mm-hmm. And he would, by convenience, have to mention Jesus the Christ, mm-hmm, to separate him from any other name.
Yeah, I was going to say, too, but by the late 90s A.D., which is when he's writing this, or at least the mid-90s A.D., you know, they even insert the. He didn't say he was the Christ. He said he was Christ. Nowadays, you know, even high school Christian kids are sometimes shocked to find out that Christ was not Jesus' last name. That when we say Jesus Christ, we're saying Jesus the Messiah. But for all practical purposes, Christ has become, in the minds of most people, Jesus' last name. It is quite possible, and it is what I think Mark was implying, it was quite possible that by 97 A.D., Jesus had a monopoly on the word Christ, that it was to the point where if you said Christ, everybody thought you meant Jesus. That's how big of an impact he had. So it was almost like the Jews felt like he stole their title.
They fooled you off the snake.
And so whatever the case, what did Joseph Smith
say? In the Book of Mormon, the angel tells Mary, and his name will be Jesus Christ.
Oh, really? Yeah, he's got some real, he's born in Jerusalem, too. But whatever the case, Most historical scholars who have studied Josephus acknowledge that Josephus did say something about Jesus there. Now, what Habermas does is he found that says in 1972, Professor Shlomo Pines of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem released the results of a study on an Arabic manuscript containing Josephus' statement about Jesus. It includes a different and briefer rendering of the entire passage, including changes in the keywords listed above. Now, what the fact of the matter is, most scholars will accept the smaller reading or the larger reading. Very few scholars will reject both. Okay? So, either the Christian people exaggerated it, which is possible, but, to me that would be so unethical, but it's possible, okay? People who call themselves Christians have done all kinds of rotten things. it just seems counterproductive to argue for Christianity and telling lies to do it. But whatever the case, it could also be that an Arabic, an Arab scholar watered it down. And I don't remember the exact date of the manuscript, but I don't think it's very early. I don't think we have any manuscripts of Josephus.
The original Greek version.
And when was the original Greek version? Do you know when?
Well, it would have to be done in my lifetime.
Right? The original Greek.
But
by saying it's not early, I don't think, we're finding little fragments of the gospel, which could date to 120 A.D., maybe earlier, John Rylands. We quite possibly found some of the Dead Sea Scrolls of Mark 6 that date to the 70s. You don't find that with anything else. So, I'd be surprised if that, if you're going to find, I wouldn't be surprised if that, I can't say for sure. Maybe Whiston refers to it, I don't know. In fact, I don't think it was found when Whiston was doing his work, but whatever the case, I wouldn't be surprised if it was 7th or 8th century.
Wow.
Fragment, okay?
So I guess Aristotle was thinking of an applied one.
What's that?
If it's true first, then...
It's one of those deals where what's really good is...
I don't know if it's good. He died a Jew. Mm-hmm. And he just wrote down the truth,
What Mark said, if he just said, the Jesus I'm talking about is the Jesus who everybody calls Christ. If that's all he meant by that, and if he said, from my looking into it, this guy seemed to be, he was a rabbi, would most likely have been aligned with the Pharisees, kind of radical in some of his teachings, but I've met a lot of people that said he performed miracles, and I met a lot of people that said they saw him alive after his death. And said, I'm just going to write it down. At the same time, when you read his history and some ancient history, some ancient historians would hear a story and say, boy, what a bunch of baloney, and then record it just as the people told it.
Yeah.
Another the historian didn't necessarily have to. It's kind of like, well, these guys, that's what they said, and they're the experts, not me, so I'll just record it like that and let the people decide.
When the historian of that time has to mention something about Christ or Christianity, then it's questioned. It's never questioned,
mm-hmm.
as if though, the exaggeration by Suetonius versus,
Yeah.
Here's that point that you made about Michael Martin, because here's Josephus getting second or probably even third, fifth hand information. And like you said, he just rose from the dead, whatever, but okay, that's it, and just wrote it down.
Well, the thing with Josephus, you're not getting, if he's trying to do a good job, and from the size of his book, and from as extensive the work was, I think we have to assume he's trying to do a very good job. If you live from 37 to 97 AD, he's got access. If not, and he had access earlier, if he had an interest in history before the destruction of the temple, he had access to a good portion of the apostles. If his historical concerns about Christ came only later, he still could have quite possibly had access to either John or John's pupils or other pupils of the apostles. But I'd say at most, this guy is talking to guys on the level of early apostolic fathers, Clement of Rome type guys, guys taught by the apostles and appointed leaders.
If he did, probably would have mentioned it, but never quotes scripture or anything in there, never quotes any of the quotes.
I think it's a word of mouth.
Right.
I think, but basically what I'm saying is I don't think Josephus is going to go into a congregation and pull out some guy sitting in the back of the church and ask him what Christianity, what Jesus is all about. I think he's going to wait for the service to end and talk to the preacher. And I think the preacher is going to say, hey, wait, if you're doing something this important, why don't you talk to this big gun in our city or in our area or whatever. And in other words, he's got access to people who worked with the apostles and most likely were appointed by the apostles. But what I'm saying is the early date and having access to Jerusalem, first century, this guy's talking to big guns. So we're not like five generations removed.
I don't really think so. But, I mean, it's great that he mentions it, but only briefly. And it's so brief, he didn't think of it that important. And most of the stuff, I mean, the guy, I read half the stuff, but and then, you know, he does give the Jews a good life, but it's horribly exaggerated.
Oh, yeah, but see, and that's what I'm getting at, is he's willing to go with exaggeration. And so why not, when you're going to report beliefs that you don't believe in, but if you know, it's almost like you're writing history not just to inform, but to entertain. And so I think he could just say, hey, you know, if they say he rose from the dead, I'll put that in there and let them decide. But what I'm getting at is the time frame doesn't put you five generations removed. This guy is right there. I mean, it's as easy to talk to Joe Schmo, bottom of the rung Christian, as it is the leading elder in Jerusalem. So it just seems to me like you know, he's doing some reporting and he says, hey, I'll put in a paragraph about Jesus of Nazareth. I think it's important enough to put a little paragraph in. But it just seems to me like he probably would go to Christian leadership at that time. And the Christian leadership at that time in that part of the world and first century, you're talking guys who fought shoulder to shoulder with the apostles.
Yeah, that's great, because I mean, here's a guy who's Jewish, embraces Judaism, goes to the far as exaggerating it.
Yeah.
So when he gives a little bit about Christianity, it's accurate.
Yeah.
But regardless of who he talks to, you can just verify from that one passage of what he said is accurate.
Yeah.
From the apostles.
Well, the thing is that, like I say, the leading Josephan scholar says that passage belongs there. Okay? And that's why it's in Whiston's work. Most Josephan scholars say it doesn't. You know, but they'll leave in a whole bunch of weird stuff.
Right.
When it comes to Jesus, no, this has got to be removed.
Right.
But and they were saying this before 1972. Now, 1972, you get this, they translate the Arabic portion of it. But the fact of the matter is, like Habermas argues, even if you take the watered-down version and assume that Christians exaggerated it, listen to what you have in the watered-down version. The Habermas states, in 1972, Professor Shlomo Pines of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem released the results of a study on an Arabic manuscript containing Josephus' statement about Jesus. It includes a different and briefer rendering of the entire passage, including changes in the key words listed above. Okay, so he says this, "At this time there was a wise man who was called Jesus, and his conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. And many people from among the Jews and other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die. And those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he had appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion and that he was alive. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah concerning whom the prophets have recounted wonders." So, he doesn't say he was the Christ. He doesn't say that he did rise from the dead, but he says, hey, you know, that those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he had appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion and that he was alive, and that he was perhaps the Messiah. But the fact of the matter is, the vast majority, I wouldn't be surprised if 9 out of 10 Josephan scholars would say, well, you've got to accept one of the two. And most would favor the shorter reading. But even if you favor the shorter reading, what is he saying? He's saying, look, I talked to the people of the mid-90s AD, the people and probably the leadership of the Christian church in the Jerusalem area, the mid-90s AD, the close of the first century, and they said that the disciples did not give up on their faith in Jesus because he appeared to them alive 3 days after his death, and that he was perhaps the Messiah. So, basically, he's saying that people who knew the eyewitnesses said the eyewitnesses claimed that they saw him risen from the dead, and that's why they didn't forsake him. So, again, that's enough rope for the apologist to hang, you know, the anti-Christian argumentation.
So. Well, it also depends on the historical Jesus. See, even in the secular world, because then now if you deny something that magnitude, you have to deny the existence of people like Napoleon and others.
Well, that's where, now, Michael Martin is a philosophy professor. He's not a historical scholar, but he did get his information from G.A. Wells, who was a historical scholar. But he's the only historical scholar of, like, the last 100 years who denied the existence of Jesus. So the guy stands all alone. But again, the guy believes that the Gospels were all fabrications. The guy was using outdated scholarship, late dates for the Gospels. But even Wells had to acknowledge that Paul wrote early. Okay? But he's got all these weird, fanciful theories about what Paul was talking about, because Paul really wasn't, when he was saying that Jesus died and rose, he really didn't know what he was talking about, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, but Josephus got this information from unreliable people who got it from the unreliable. So, I mean, it's like nothing... Nothing could possibly count as evidence. What kind of historical scholarship is that, where nothing could possibly count as evidence for the primary events of the Christian faith? I mean, basically what Wells is saying, I'm a historian who's made up my mind before I do my historical research. Yeah. Miracles don't happen. Therefore, this stuff is bogus. And the apostles were biased, they were telling myths, or whoever the authors of the Gospels were, they were telling myths, and these other guys bought it, including Josephus. They were just writing down what these myth makers wrote. So whatever way we look at it, if we're going to be honest with the evidence, we would have to admit that ancient secular writers do confirm the message of the early church. They don't say, hey, we believe this stuff. but they tell us what the early church taught, and lo and behold, it's the same things that we have in the New Testament, the exact things that are rejected by liberal critics today.
Well, it's not just that the teachings, but they also acknowledge the thing about it's great we have all those ancient evidence, but it's too bad we don't have any from secularists who actually saw Jesus. I mean, they'll acknowledge that, oh yeah, these Christians, they say that this guy Jesus was here, they teach this, you know, they acknowledge what they teach, but they're not witnesses to these things. They never saw, they don't recall. It'd be great if Josephus was like, yeah, I went to go visit this John guy, and oh, right in front of me, he healed five people, and they told me about the Christ. Yeah, it'd be great, but no, it's all secondhand.
Well, the issue, because if they didn't see something like that, they may have become Christians.
Yeah,
and,
well,
and then they're considered
biased. And then they're biased right there.
Okay, Paul was a big name enemy of Christianity, who then, when confronted by Jesus, became a believer. So then all of a sudden now he's in the bias category. At the same time, having said that, you know, firsthand ancient accounts sound great, but once you step outside of the New Testament, they're almost non-existent.
Right.
So when we talk second, third, fourth, fifth generation accounts, that's pretty much what you get with ancient literature. In other words, it's almost impossible, unless the guy's recording his own accomplishments, it's almost impossible to find anything that anybody said, yeah, I witnessed this. You know, it's usually they'll write down, well, it has been said or it was written that such and such occurred, and the guy's writing 300 years after the event.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing that so much is demanded from the New Testament for it to be reliable, and so little is needed for anything else to be considered reliable. Now, having said that, we do have a guy, Thallus, who apparently saw the darkness at Christ's crucifixion, and he's trying to explain it away. And
wait a minute, if I remember his account, he just heard about the darkness and then tried to explain it. I don't think he was there.
Well, it's reported by Africanus,
right?
Who was a Christian.
Oh, there you go, the bias right away. He's getting his knowledge.
Well, see, and then that's another approach that Michael Martin takes, is that because Africanus is a Christian, he's probably making up the account from Thallus. But that's not the way. If we do that, and you know, violate Aristotle's dictum that something is reliable unless proven to be unreliable, if we do that, if we get the green light there, basically you can bring your presuppositions in and just tear out anything you want. But a lot of good, solid historical knowledge that we have of ancient literature is because somebody else 300 years later quoted the guy. Other than that, we don't even know anything about the guy.
Yeah, and it's also the ludicrous idea that, well, Africanus was biased and he made it up. And so was Clement of Alexandria. So it's a whole conspiracy throughout the whole, you know, it's like, well, then everybody is just ridiculous. It's just ludicrous to think that.
Yeah, I'm looking for the...
But one of the cases, though, the point was that we have all this quote-unquote evidence, but it's good evidence for what early Christians taught and what they acknowledged. And I guess it's good that, because these people... Actually, now that I think of it, none of them say, I talk to these Christians who saw Christ. I mean, we don't have any references of Paul. No, you don't have Gamaliel's writings. Paul is going to be great, but he went Christian on me. We have nothing about those guys.
Well, the historical evidence for Paul by the most fire-breathing anti-Christian New Testament scholars on the planet, there is like almost nobody who rejects the authenticity of Paul's letters, with the exception of 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. And the only reason why they're rejected It's because it's claimed that there's too much church organization for that early in the history of the church. But the problem is it's only the same amount of organization that you find in the synagogues at that time. But whatever the case, what I'm getting at is you'd have to go a long way to find an anti-Christian scholar, historical scholar or New Testament scholar. And the New Testament scholars tend to be much more biased than historical scholars, by the way. But whatever the case, you'd have to go, because the New Testament scholars are more likely to spin.